Yes, we can start the Dhamma talk for this morning, for today, on the Vaisak day. I was very impressed today with this member of parliament who knew so much about Buddhism. It's quite remarkable. Some of the things he said were quite perceptive. He obviously has a good understanding of the Buddha's teachings. And you don't find that in many countries around the world. You find it maybe in a few places in Southeast Asia, Singapore, Thailand, Burma, no doubt. But most of the world, people have no clue about the Dhamma, people in government. So maybe that can change over time, but right now it's not happening in the West, that's for sure. So that's a wonderful thing, and it's a beautiful thing to have a patron like that, part of the Buddhist Fellowship. And of course he was talking about peace and harmony here in Singapore, and I'm not going to talk about how to achieve peace and harmony in Singapore. It's beyond me to have any idea how to do that. You seem to be doing quite well already on your own. What I'm going to talk about instead is how to have peace and harmony inside of yourself, your personal peace and harmony. Because really, that's where it all starts. If you have a sense of peace and harmony within yourself, it tends to go outside to other people as well. It's like it has these circles. It goes outside to the circle of people around you. And it hits that circle, and then it goes out another circle. All those people and all those people. And it has this kind of, you know, ripple effect where it ripples out to more and more people. So it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. I mean, imagine the Buddha. The Buddha was one single man. And imagine the kind of ripple effect that one single man has had over 2,500 years. And that's really all it is. It's one man doing, being peaceful, teaching about peace. And then people today, after 2,500 years, still benefiting from those wonderful teachings. Now, one of those teachings of the Buddha, I'm sure many of you have read, the beautiful book called the Dhammapada. Dhammapada is one of the most famous of the Buddha's teachings. It has, you know, 300 and, what is it now, 340 verses, something like that. And some of the teachings, I recommend you to read the Dhammapada, because there's so many beautiful teachings in a small little book just like that. Wonderful teachings. And reflect on those teachings. Read maybe one verse a day, sometimes only one line of verse a day, and reflect deeply on that verse or that one line. And you will come to understand so much just by reading that one single book. Now there's one line of that Dhammapada book. This is verse 204, if you want to look it up later on. And in this one verse, there's one line which says, it says, contentment is the highest wealth. It's a beautiful saying. It relates very strongly to the talk that I'm giving today about peace. Contentment is the highest wealth. Now reflect on that. What does that mean, contentment is the highest wealth? It can mean many things. One thing it can mean is that of all things that are considered wealth, contentment is the highest. Like the best type of wealth you can have is contentment. That's one understanding of that particular line. But there is a more profound understanding. And this profound understanding is that if you are content, then the surge, the drive, the desire to always run on, always try to get something else, always try to move on in the world, go somewhere else, that ceases. You become peaceful instead. Remember that when you are, you can be as rich as you want, you can be the richest man in the world, but if you still want more, if you still desire more, it means that you're not wealthy enough. Because you still want more. You still have this drive to go somewhere else. This move to move forwards to some other destination, some whatever it is. The drive is still there inside of you. But when you're content, you have actually reached the goal of your desires. You've reached the goal of your craving. Because the goal of the craving is always to try to find that satisfaction in life. Find that contentment. It's a very profound saying. If you understand the simple idea of contentment is the highest wealth, essentially you understand what it means to be peaceful, what it means to be satisfied with what you have. This does not mean that it's wrong to be rich, it doesn't mean it's wrong to be successful, it doesn't mean that these things are wrong. All it means is that whatever you have, whatever level you're at, you're happy with that, you're content with that, and then you do have the highest wealth. Then you're there, you have achieved the goal that you're trying to achieve. So that is really all I need to say today, but I'm going to talk a little bit more anyway, because it's probably good to expand on these things, because when you expand on these things, it often sinks in even more deeply what this is all about. Now, one of the ways that I approach this idea of peace and happiness is to understand it in terms of the meaning in life, the meaning of life. And I remember myself when I was a young man, even as a teenager, I always used to think, what is the meaning of life? What is the purpose of life? It's the kind of thought that all young people have. You know, where am I going? How should I be spending my life? All these kind of things. You know, what religion should I choose? What kind of career should I have? Now, if you can understand the meaning of life, first of all, you know, what is the purpose of life, it becomes much easier to make those decisions, because then you have a guide. So people search for the meaning of life when they're younger. And you want to find out, what is the purpose of all this? And I remember myself, when I was thinking about the meaning of life, I always used to think, you know, what is the purpose? What is the kind of the goal? What am I trying to achieve? What is the kind of the end point I try to go to? Is there some kind of, a heavenly realm or some kind of ideal situation that I'm trying to achieve? Is there a goal in life? That was the kind of thinking. And this is the kind of thinking which I think is very common. This idea that there is some specific purpose, a particular place, a particular thing that you're trying to achieve, whether it's a material thing or even perhaps a spiritual thing. And you can see that also in religions around the world. You have all this kind of New Age religions that have been popular for quite a while now, certainly in the West. And the idea is always this focus on creating something like a harmonious society, a society like moving towards the omega point, moving towards the kind of universal consciousness where everybody is happy and pleased and we work together in a nice, beautiful way. And it sounds very attractive and very beautiful if that was possible. It sounds great. It's exactly what everybody wants. But is it really possible? Now that, of course, is the great question. And all these things, I realized later on, are just like pies in the sky. Because, you know, from the Buddha's point of view, from the Buddha's teaching, things are impermanent, things change. There is no particular direction that things are pointing towards, always going better, always going worse. And as I became a Buddhist, I started to think of why is it that people even think in this way in the first place? Why is that we think in terms of a purpose for me, a purpose for the world, a purpose for humanity? What is the cause for that? And I realize that the reason, one of the main reasons, is because we tend to take ourselves very seriously, think, I am important, my life matters. You know, I am a kind of a small piece in this big jigsaw called the world, and I'm going to do my part to make sure we all move in the right direction, and we all arrive at this beautiful universal consciousness where we all can be happy and harmonious together. It comes from the ego. It's driven by the sense of self that we think that we have some kind of importance in life. And then you come to Buddhism and they tell you there's no sense, there's no self, there's nothing there, there's nothing really inside of you. That whole thing collapses. It doesn't work anymore. And it's the same thing with this idea that we as a humanity, you know, human race, that we have to sort of move towards some kind of point, some purpose, where we achieve the kind of the ultimate stability and the ultimate happiness together. Where does that come from? That comes from a very similar thing. I think that comes largely from the idea that the universe, the world, was created with a purpose. It comes from the idea of a creator God, which is such a prevalent idea in the world. Almost all religions have this idea of a creator God. And that's where it comes from, because you can imagine, if the world was created by somebody, it makes sense that it should have a purpose, right? Why would somebody bother creating everything unless there was a purpose to it? There must be a meaning, there must be a goal, we must be going somewhere. But if you take away the idea of a creator God, and in Buddhism there is no idea of a creator God, then the universe is just there. It doesn't really need any purpose anymore. There's no any idea that we're actually going anywhere. That whole thing just disappears. And suddenly the universe is just this thing which does its own thing according to the laws of nature. And that's all there's to it. And there's no purpose. And that is like, when there's no purpose, you feel a sense of despair. What do you mean there's no purpose? That's terrible. What am I going to do with my life? It's just all suffering for absolutely no reason. Well, that is really, sounds really awful. But the way then to find the meaning of life and to understand what the meaning of life is a different route, a different trajectory. rather than speculating about ultimate meaning and ultimate purpose and ultimate goals and all these things, there is another way of looking at the meaning of life. And to really find the meaning of life, you have to look inside of yourself. That is where you find and you understand the meaning of life. When you look inside of yourself, what do you see here? What do you think you see when you look inside of it? One of the main things that you see here when you look inside of yourself is this desire, this craving, always driving you around here, driving you around there, going from this, going from that, going from one relationship to another, from one house to another, from one car to another, always driving you forward, moving you somewhere else. Now what is it about this craving? What is this craving trying to achieve? What is the purpose of this craving here? And when you look inside of yourself, you always see here that the purpose of this craving is to try to satisfy you, for you to try to find contentment. That is what the craving is there for. The thinking is, if you look carefully, and you have to look carefully always, you see that the desire always, the idea is that it promises you, when you get this thing, when you get to this stage, when you get to this point, then you will be happy, then you will be satisfied. That is the promise of craving. And this is not just a doctrine of Buddhism that you have to believe because, you know, the Buddha said so, or I say so, or whoever says so. This is something that you can observe in your own life. Indeed, if you do observe these things in your own life, that is when they become very powerful, because you can see the truth of these things. Ask yourself, when you have a desire, what is actually the promise of this desire? What is this desire telling you? And it always is that you will find satisfaction, you will find happiness when this craving, when this purse gets slated through whatever object you're trying to pursue. But, and again this is the Buddha's teachings, you find that that craving is always unfaithful to its promise. It's a beautiful way of looking at it. The craving is unfaithful to its promise, because the promise says you'll be satisfied. But you get there and you find another craving always arises afterwards. There is no satisfaction. There is no end point. There is no, it doesn't actually ever happen. And despite this, despite if you look inside of yourself, you can see this reality so clearly. It is so obvious that this is the way things work. But despite that, the vast majority of people keep on running after the craving, always thinking, next one is going to bring satisfaction. This is your experience. This is your personal sense. This is how it actually feels when you run after these things. And that is why the world keeps on running around, following craving, trying to find satisfaction in this way. It never actually works. It never actually is possible to find that satisfaction in this way. And this is very powerful. We are all seeking for that peace. We're all seeking for the contentment through it. We can look inside ourselves and see that this is actually what we want. And we're doing it in the wrong way, again and again and again, by following the craving, by allowing the craving to lead us by the nose, and would never reach that what we actually want to reach. This is called delusion, this is called misunderstanding, it's called lack of insight, lack of understanding of how we actually work. And this is here the real problem that we are faced with. The question, of course, is, well, if it doesn't work, if craving doesn't work, if it doesn't get there, what can we do? And sometimes people have this idea that, well, what we have to do is just chuck out all the craving, get rid of the craving, and then everything will be fine. It's like one of those things people often talk about, attachments. I often surprise people think, oh, okay, if I'm not detached, if I'm attached, I'm a bad Buddhist, if I'm attached, really bad Buddhist. But what does that lead to? It leads to guilt feeling. You feel guilty because you have attachments. You can't just overcome your attachment by saying, no more attachments, end of attachments. It doesn't work like that, because if you are a human being, you have a sense of self. That sense of self is always going to give rise to attachments. That is what a sense of self does by its very nature. A sense of self is something which has objects that it owns. If it doesn't own anything else, it owns the body or the mind. It attaches. And craving is exactly the same thing. If you have a sense of self, if you have been born into this world, if you have the delusion that comes with all that, you are going to crave. You can't just say, snap, no more craving. It doesn't work like that. So what you have to do instead, and this is of course the answer that you all know about already, what you have to do instead to overcome that craving and to move towards contentment is to practice the Buddhist path. This is the way to find that peace. You understand eventually craving is not going to get you there. There must be another way. And through that practice of the Noble Eightfold Path, you don't overcome craving like that. You gradually overcome it, stage by stage, as it decreases in your life. And you can see that. I'm sure many of you who are here now, who have been Buddhists for a long time already, you know, you realize that through the practice of the Buddhist path, you are actually becoming more peaceful. You are becoming more content. There is less craving in your life. And you can feel the beauty of that. It's a very beautiful and wonderful feeling when you don't always have to run after things. You don't always have to satisfy all your whims and all your desires for this and that. It's a very powerful and beautiful feeling. How does it work? And I think always one of the most important things that Buddhist teachers should do is to explain how things actually work. Because when you understand how these things work, then you will put more effort into the practice because you can actually see that this makes sense. It's logical. It's not just a matter of dogma or belief. It's a logical thing. The way it works is as follows. When you practice the Buddhist path, you're trying to be good. You do acts of generosity. You speak kind words. You do good deeds. You think kind thoughts. What happens when you do that? Have you ever looked into your mind when you do something kind? When you do something kind, say spontaneously, you see somebody who needs a hand, you see somebody who needs an offering or a gift, something, and you spontaneously give yourself to this other person. What happens in your heart? How do you feel about that? And it feels beautiful inside. You feel a sense of joy, of happiness at doing a spontaneous act of kindness. And the more kindness you do, every time you do something, you have this sense of spontaneous joy, and it also leaves an imprint in the mind. That joy is not something which disappears. It leaves an imprint in the mind. So that later on, when you reflect back on that incident, when you did something nice, did something good, you again can experience the same joy, the same happiness that you had when you initially did it. So you are building something up. You're building up happiness upon happiness. You're building up beauty upon beauty as you are lifting yourself up through doing good acts more and more. And then there's also the reverse side of this. The reverse side is that when you do something bad, it tends to drag you down. How do you feel when you say something that you shouldn't have said, or you do something that you shouldn't have done, or even thought something you shouldn't think as a Buddhist, you realize it is not the right thing? You tend to feel a little bit not happy afterwards. You feel a little bit sad, I shouldn't have done that. There's something inside of you which knows, there's conscience inside of you which knows this isn't right. There's a little bit of darkness inside. There isn't that brightness anymore that you normally have. It drags you down a little bit. So then by reducing the bad things and doing the good things, what you're doing is you're building up this sense of brightness inside of your mind. Your mind becomes clearer, the mindfulness becomes stronger, the joy arises, the joy becomes more powerful. And you're literally cutting the fetters which keep you grounded to the ground so you can soar up into the air like a balloon with helium because of the brightness and the lightness of the mind. You feel light inside, you feel bright inside. And this is how it actually works. This is how the happiness comes gradually. Of course, this is very difficult to do. It's very difficult to change yourself. It's very hard to become a more kind person. But it is the only thing worthwhile in this world. It's the only thing which really satisfies those things that you really want to have satisfied. It's the only thing which gives the answer to the meaning of life, which is finding that contentment inside, finding that peace inside, which we're all searching for in the wrong way. This is the way that you have to do it. And as you keep doing this, as you keep practicing in this way, what is actually happening, because your mind is brightening up, because you feel more happiness, it means that you become less dependent on the external things for your happiness in the world. You become an independent person. You have a sense of happiness inside of you, a joy which doesn't relate to the external world. And it doesn't matter so much anymore whether you have that big house or you have a small shack, whether you drive, you ride a bicycle or you drive a Ferrari. It doesn't really matter so much. Okay, you may still have a little bit of craving. You may still think that that Ferrari looks really nice when you see it on the road. Even I sometimes when I see a Ferrari, I think, oh, that's a very nice car. But I can let go of it reasonably quickly. It doesn't really bother me that much. And this is the thing with you as well. It doesn't bother you so much anymore. A little bit of desire might still be there, but it's not so important. And you get this beautiful independence inside of you. It means that you can walk through the world. You can have your sorrows. You can have your happinesses. They don't touch you so much anymore. You become a free individual. And that peace becomes much more profound than it could ever otherwise be. A contentment arises inside of you. You feel really good about these things. And there is another thing which I should also mention, which gives rise to a lot of problems in life, and it takes away from your peace. One of them is craving. I talked about craving now and how to overcome that according to the Buddhist path. Craving is a problem. It always drives you around, pulls you by the nose, and makes sure that you're never peaceful, you're never happy. But there is another thing also which drives you around. And that other thing is the sense of self, the doer inside of you, the thing inside of you which always likes to do things, which always likes to manipulate and control the world, and to sort of be successful with things in life, and actually go out there. And this is so common in our society. People get a buzz, they get something by going out there and doing lots of stuff, and they feel that they are achieving things. It actually increases this sense of the doer inside. There is a very kind of strong sense of me and ego attached to that. The feeling that I am achieving something, it feels good. So the doing in itself, the very acting, the very idea of being in charge and doing things in the world is a very seductive thing. It seduces the ego because the ego feels good when you do and you achieve and you actually get things done. But be careful with that one as well, because the reason why you have to be careful that is not that it's bad to do things. We all have to do things in life. We all have to achieve certain things. But the danger is that if you take that too seriously, you realize that you cannot really control the world. Things are impermanent. Things change. You try to do things one way. Other people will disagree. Other people will go in a different direction. And instead of actually achieving those things that you want to achieve, very often, sometimes you end up with arguments. You end up with problems. You end up with all kind of... Because one person goes one way, one person goes the other way. So this doer inside of us, which always wants to carry us, make us achieve things so we can satisfy the sense of ego inside which wants to do stuff, is actually very often leads in the opposite direction. It leads to problems and it leads to disharmony and it can lead to all kind of problems in our life. And this is the thing, and this is one of the things that you have to reflect on, just reflecting like that, understanding that the doing, you can never actually control things, means that you start to become less interested in that side of life. And you realize, of course, that once you start practicing this path, once you start to become more peaceful, not only do you realize that the doing itself doesn't give the results that you want to have, but actually it's quite painful. All this running around, always trying to use your willpower, it is not a peaceful state. The peaceful state where you can be really at ease and really relaxed is much more desirable. It's much more. It feels much better than the state of achieving things through doing. So this is the other thing which is the problem in people, is the ego that wants to do and the craving. These are the two things. The first thing to look out for is the craving. That's by far the worst one. And then you can also think about the doing afterwards. How much time have I got to speak for? Is there any limit, or should I just keep going?
One more.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll keep going a little bit longer. One of the things about the monastic life, because I'm a monk, I need to talk a little bit about the monastic life as well. One of the things about the monastic life is, and why it actually leads in the right direction here, you can see that the monastic life is a very simple lifestyle. It doesn't really give you much chance to crave or to have lots of desires. Even when, if I see that Ferrari in the street, I may like it. I know I can never have a Ferrari in my monastery. Which I'm very happy about, actually. I don't want to have a Ferrari in a Bodhinyana monastery. Yeah. But there isn't much you can do, you know, when you go back to your little hut in the forest in the monastery. Yeah. All I have is like 7 square meters in my little hut. And I have a walking path in front, and I have the trees all around. So there isn't much I can crave for. There isn't really any entertainment. Okay, I can read some books in Pali and the English translations. That's about it. But because you can't crave very much, and after a while, having been a monk for a long time, you accept that you can't crave. So because you accept it, this is my situation, you actually, the craving starts to subside. So monastic life is actually made for non-craving. And this is one of the reasons why the monastic life is so powerful. So sometimes, as a layperson, reflect on that as well, because maybe that will sort of also draw you in the right direction. Reflect that the monastic life is one of contentment, one of few desires. It's the only way that you can live happy in monastic life, if you have that sense of contentment. Otherwise, it's going to drive you nuts, sitting in that little cutie, always thinking about all the things that you want. You can imagine how difficult that is. So if you don't want to be nuts, you just have to let go of the craving. It drives you automatically in the right direction. And the other thing about monastic life is that it takes away very much of the sense of self. Of course, if you go around and give talks in different places, you can sort of sometimes have to be careful, don't take yourself too seriously giving talks. But when you live monastic life, most of the time you're just one of the monks in the line. You know, you look like the next monk, you shave your head. And very often the lay people who come to the monastery, they don't know who you are, you know. They have some idea about Ajahn Brahm, but everybody else is just one mass of monks coming after her. And that's wonderful. It's a great thing, because it means, again, you don't take yourself too seriously. It means that you let go of the doing, you can let go of being anybody, and you can just be this one person, this one robe walking through there. And that's a wonderful thing to do. So this is the idea. This is why monastic life works so well, because you have that non-craving, and you have that non-identity, where you don't actually identify too much with anything at all. You try to sort of fade into the background. They say the best monks are the ones who fade the most into the background. So that's how you know whether somebody... One of the ways to find out whether somebody is a good monk, they sort of fade away. But then, as you keep on practicing the Buddhist teachings, as you keep on going up, you become more and more peaceful. And one of the once you start to find the real peace, that, of course, is in the meditation practice. When, through your virtue, through your kindness, you start to feel bright inside of you, your mindfulness becomes more powerful, then when you sit down and you close your eyes and you try to watch the breath, it becomes quite easy. It becomes easy because you are happy in the present moment. The reason why you keep on thinking about this, you keep falling asleep and all these things, is because you're not really happy, you don't really want to be here, right? If you're not happy, you're going to dream about something. But when the more happy you are, the more easy it is to be mindful, because you want to be here and now in the present moment. So that is how it works. This is why this path works. You get the happiness, then you go on a retreat somewhere, maybe you come to Jhana Grove, or you wherever you go, it doesn't matter where you go, and you find yourself that over the years you become more peaceful, more satisfied, and you can actually do this meditation, which sometimes people find so difficult to do. And then as you calm down more and more, you see the peace becomes more powerful. You understand for the first time in life what peace actually is. And then the first time you find really deep samadhi, when you really become peaceful, everything becomes so quiet. And you have the most wonderful, the most blissful experience that in your whole life that you have ever had. And you realize that most blissful and powerful experience, why was it so peaceful? Why was it so blissful? Because it is peaceful. Because there is no doing, because there is no craving, because there is no movement here and there, there is no going anywhere. That is why it is such a blissful experience. And to give you some ideas, the way the Buddha taught about these things, because the Buddha's teachings are always the most powerful, And I always recommend you to read the word of the Buddha, because that is where the real teachings are. It can be so confusing listening to this teacher, that teacher, and one says one thing, another says something else, and you wonder who is right. Maybe they're both right, but sometimes it seems to be contradictory. So it's great to see what the Buddha said. And what the Buddha said is that as you become more blissed out, as you become more happy in your meditation experiences, at the same time, the state of the mind is more peaceful and more quiet. These things go together. Ultimately, the state of the mind is so peaceful, so quiet, that there's nothing at all happening in the mind. It's completely quiet. The only thing there is bliss, nothing else. Now, that is quite remarkable. It's quite amazing. Imagine having a state of mind where nothing moves. Absolutely still. Nothing at all moves. Maybe for hour after hour after hour, nothing is happening except bliss. Why is it so blissful? Because it is peaceful. Because there's nothing at all happening here. Now, it goes even beyond that, because this is about the meaning of life. So I can take you even a little bit deeper to give you some idea of how far this actually goes. Because it goes even beyond that. And one of the things that is so remarkable about the Buddha's teachings, it is so profound sometimes. It is very hard to get your mind around to really understand what is going on. But the Buddha says, as you go beyond even the initial stages of samadhi, of deep meditation, you go even deeper. And what happens, there comes a point when the bliss disappears. The bliss disappears, right? This is even more peaceful, because the bliss is like a small like irritation almost in the mind. It's very hard to understand how bliss can be an irritation. But the idea here is that you come to a point where all you feel is peace. Nothing but peace, nothing but equanimity, nothing but pure mindfulness. And that, the Buddha says, is even happier and experiencing bliss. When all you experience is equanimity, all you experience is peace, nothing else, it's even more desirable, even more something you have even more reason to get than something which is purely blissful. It is mind-boggling. This is very, very profound. How can this pure peace, it doesn't sound very interesting, does it? Pure peace, just being peaceful. But it is, according to Buddha's teachings, this is now you are reaching towards the highest possible happiness that is experienceable by human beings or any beings anywhere. This is happiness at its very highest. So to understand this, you have to keep practicing the path. As you keep practicing the path, you will see why this is true. And you will see how gradually you're moving in that direction. The craving subsides because you understand that following your craving is never actually going to give rise to the result which you want to give rise to, which is the ending of craving, the seeking of peace. It is the path which gives rise to that peace. So watch out in your own mind as you practice the Dhamma. Make sure that you actually do find that peace in your life. Is it working for you? Is it giving you rise to more peace? The reason I'm a Buddhist monk, to be quite honest, is because I have found over the 15 years I've been a monk, it has given rise to more peace, more happiness. If it hadn't, I probably would have been disrobed a long time ago. The whole purpose is to give rise to that peace. So look inside of yourself. Does it give this result? And if it is giving the right result, you know that you are moving in the right direction. You need to have some idea of whether you're going in the right direction. And if it isn't giving the result, then you ask yourself, why? Am I doing something wrong? Is there something I could change? Do I need to deepen my practice or something else? I think I'm supposed to stop now, is that? Okay. So, should I do it? Or should
do it? Okay, I'll do it. Somebody has been waiting for quite a few minutes for this car to be moved. SJK4411U, White Mazda. SJK4411U. Is that your? No, not. None of you? Okay, thank you.
Okay, anyway, I think that gives you a good idea about the Buddhist path. I think it's a good time to stop the talk. So would you like, anybody like to ask any questions? We can, please, this is the chance. So whatever you want to ask about, this is this is your opportunity. It doesn't have to be about this topic. One person over there.
Can I ask, Venerable, if let's say someone is having illness, how are you going to have peace in your mind when you are very disturbed by the physical suffering?
How can you have peace in your mind when you're disturbed by physical suffering? It is one of the things that you have to. This is very. So much of the Buddha's teachings is about accepting things for what they are, understanding when you can do something, do something. When you can't do anything, don't try to solve something which you can't do anything about. And I think there was. In Ajahn Brahm's book, there is this story about this English prime minister you ever heard about, Harold Macmillan, who was a prime minister back in the 1960s or whatever it was. And he was asked once about the problems in the Middle East, because in the Middle East there had been a problem for a long time. And back in the 1960s, there was already problems in the Middle East, long before that, of course, as well. And he was asked about, what are we going to do about the problem in the Middle East? And he replied, there is no problem in the Middle East. You know that story? Have you seen that one? It's in Ajahn Brahm's book, The Opening Door of Your Heart. He said, there is no problem in the Middle East. It's a very profound, answer. Sometimes you find people who have some understanding of an insight into things. Why is there no problem in the Middle East? Because there is no solution in the Middle East. If there is no solution, there is no problem. Right? The point is that if there is no solution to something, you don't spend time worrying about it, trying to overcome something for which there is no solution. That is the point there. And it is the same thing with illness. It's the same thing with all the problems in life. Sometimes there is something you can do about illness. Sometimes there is nothing you can do. If there's nothing you can do, you have to accept your situation. And if you accept your situation, you can actually find peace with that illness itself. It's not easy to do, but that is the path by which you can actually attain some sense of peace with your illness. I remember Ajahn Brahm has probably told this story here many times of himself, and this is the kind of the classical story that he teaches. It's a story when he was in hospital in Thailand with typhus fever. And Ajahn Brahm, of course, is a very good meditator. Not everybody is like him. But he said that when he was a young monk, he was in hospital with typhus fever. Typhus fever is very, very debilitating. You lie in the bed, you can almost hardly get out of bed. That is how bad it was. He said that when he was walking, he had to go to the toilet. It took him sort of half an hour to the toilet, half an hour back, even though it was only 30 meters away. And he had to sort of hold on to the beds because he was afraid of falling over. And that was how ill he was. But he said that even then, he was actually able to let go of the body and go into deep meditation, whereby the body disappears completely and all you have is bliss. So you can see that it is with the main problem with everything in life is the craving, the desire for things to be different from what they are, for people in our lives to be different from what they are. It is a desire which often is the main problem. If you can accept and say, okay, this is my problem, I have physical suffering, I'm going to do my best to deal with it through medicines or through therapy or through seeing doctors, whatever, but what I cannot change, I'm going to have to accept. And I'm going to make the best of my life with that condition I'm in. I can still be kind. I can still be a good person, even though I have this physical suffering. I'm going to have to accept it. And then you find that once you accept it fully, once you embrace it, once you say, oh, this is suffering, but I will accept that suffering, then it's not a problem anymore. Once you think it's unfair, why me, why is this, then you get angry, you get upset. Once you understand that this is part of life, this is suffering, you're not angry anymore. You just say, okay, I'm going to have to live with this, it's going to have to be this way. And don't get angry anymore. That is the most important thing. Don't get upset and angry. Have acceptance instead. Does that make sense, sir? Yeah?
You have another question?
Thank you. Ajahn Brahmali, you had mentioned that sometimes people wanting to achieve is out of fulfilling one's ego, but Buddhists have often been criticized for not doing enough, often more laid back or even in action. So where is the balance that can be struck And like in Ajahn Brahm's case, I mean, he put himself forward to ordain bhikkhuni and resulting in much disharmony within the forest tradition. So, you know, we're saying that in hindsight, he shouldn't have done it or wait another 10 years. And therefore, when is the Buddhist going to step forward to make a change? Because change will always have positive and negative impact. Thank you. Yeah. Sorry for a difficult question.
No, that's good. It's a good question. It's good to have difficult questions. So thank you for that one. I think you're right. I think, of course, it is important to do things. It's not as if we should just not do anything, not as if we shouldn't look for progress and move things forward and do what is right in the world. It's extremely important. But very often we have to be careful with, you know, I know this from my own experience, you know, before I became a monk, you know, sometimes just the very feeling of doing gives a sense of, you know, you feel empowered, you feel that, you know, you feel almost like your ego is getting inflated almost by the very act of doing it. And I think this is very common in the world. You know, you see people who are, you know, working in the finance industry and working very hard and, you know, trading and all this activity, all the doing is often very closely related, I think, to the ego, a sense that you're performing, you're doing, you're actually getting out there. So the problem is not so much the doing, it is, you know, why we're doing, where it's coming from. Are we able to let, if you're too attached to your doing, it often means you can't let go. So if there is an opposing opinion to yours, is the ability to let go, which shows how attached you are to that doing of yours, to that goal of yours, where you're heading here. It's the ability to detach, which is important. So it is not, doing is good, but you have to do in the right way, essentially. That is what it comes down to. And doing in the right way is often very difficult. And it's only when you start to reflect that actually all this doing I'm doing here, often it doesn't give the results I want, often it doesn't go in the right way. Then you start to calm down and you look for the peace instead. If they're looking for that buzz that you get from the activity itself very often. But I agree with you. I mean, with the bhikkhuni ordination in Perth and with all that thing around it, it is a very difficult thing. And of course, yes, Ajahn Brahm has been criticized for not consulting and for not really, you know, doing these things. But again, it is one of those things. I support Ajahn Brahm 100% because I know from personal experience that sometimes you cannot really consult. Sometimes there isn't any solution through the path of consultation. Because sometimes you know that the tradition is so entrenched in a certain way that sometimes you have to make like a slightly radical break with the way things are. And in hindsight, people will hopefully see that this was the right way. And of course, the other thing I think also which is very important to understand is that I asked Ajahn Brahm specifically before the bhikkhuni ordination, what is going to be the result of this when we do this? You know, what's going to happen? Are we going to get kicked out or what the pong? You know, are we going to create enemies? Is there going to be any bad results of this? Ajahn Brahm said, oh, no, it will just be a few kind of ripples on the water. That will be the end of it. It won't be any big deal. That's him, you know, because that's the way he thinks. He's a very positive person. And it's very hard for him to imagine that it would actually have such negative consequences. And it is possible, I don't know, if Ajahn Brahm had realized that it would have had such negative consequences. Maybe he would have done things differently. I don't know. It's possible. Because I don't think he wasn't aiming at the, you know, at having all this conflict. That absolutely for sure. He was aiming to do something which he thought would be of benefit for Buddhism, not only in Australia, but everywhere. That was the whole purpose of that thing. So sometimes you don't know, you know, you don't know the consequences of your actions. You do what you think is right, and then the consequences come, and you can't really tell beforehand what is right and what is wrong. So now, by all means, do. Don't stop doing. Not, of course not. But look at yourself. You know, where is it coming from? You know, am I moving towards peace, or am I moving towards more doing? Can I be peaceful with my doing? Can I act and be peaceful at the same time? These are the kind of questions you need to ask. If doing becomes something in its own right, which gives rise to a buzz, to a sense of ego, then you won't be able to be peaceful anymore because you need that buzz to keep you going. And that is where it gets dangerous, where doing becomes something which you need and you demand for your personal gratification.
Ajahn Brahmani, excuse me for my tiger ego today. My question is with regards to your talk centering about craving and ego. In our youth, or I'm not young anymore, but maybe when we are younger and we practice meditation to try to raise awareness and reduce craving, I personally find it quite a challenge. And as I progress, I find it my awareness level has risen, and my mindfulness has gone up, and my craving has lessened. And I'm just wondering, could it be due to age? Because I'm thinking as we age, the things that we need are less. And our experiences would have told us that certain things are not necessary. So how do I attribute it to my practice and not to age-related experience? Thank you.
Well, I mean, part of the practice is getting older, right? So you get wiser as you get older because you see that certain things aren't really worthwhile. This is part of it. So don't dismiss that just because it's age. Sometimes age is a good thing, and that is often why in society all people are held in certain esteem because they have experienced things in life they have an understanding that younger people don't have. So that's a good thing. But I think if you find that your mindfulness is increasing, that is a good sign because it is not given that an older person will be more mindful than a young one. Often it's the other way around. A young people is the one with a sharp mind and presence, and the old person can sometimes be not so sharp. So the fact that your mindfulness is increasing is a very good sign, I would say, that you're moving in the right direction. But don't try to attribute it to one thing or another thing. Don't worry about that, whether it's age or whether it's a practice or whatever it is. The important thing is not why, why this is happening. The important thing is that it is happening. You're going in the right direction. Be happy with that. That is what really matters. And if you feel that it is going too slowly or whatever, again, sometimes you can't control the pace, but ask yourself if there's something more you can do. And I think one of the things which is greatly underestimated in Buddhist practice and which isn't practiced enough is metta meditation. Try to understand what metta is all about. How can you have more metta in your life? How can you have change? Yeah? Okay, there we are. Okay, good. So have more metta. Okay. Should be okay, okay. So metta is a beautiful thing because metta means that you are increasing, you make things so much easier for yourself if you have a sense of metta. This is one of the foundational qualities. And actually, when you read the suttas of the Buddha, the more you read them, you find metta mentioned so many different places. It's actually a very important thing. And I think in lay life, when you meditation practice, particularly the samatha meditation and the meditation, is often so difficult and often hard to go very deep. I think very often it is useful to spend those few minutes you have every day on practicing a bit of metta instead, trying to look at the people around you in a new way, trying to be more positive and a better person. And I think often that is what will give the best results, I think, in the long run, in the lay life and monastic life as well, for that matter.
Venerable Ajahn Brahmani, I couldn't resist this comment. It's nothing to do with the bhikkhuni ordination. Ajahn Brahm is not a good monk because he doesn't fade away. joking. He tries to fade away, but people won't allow him to fade away. That's why he's still a good monk. That's not my question. My question is that I've heard a saying that all pleasure is eventually pain. Because when you have pleasure, you want more of the pleasure, and then you want more of the pleasure, and when you don't get the pleasure, that becomes pain. And this is also true of, this is my hobby horse, political power. The more political power you have, the more political power you want, and if you lose some of it, that becomes pain, you see. So this is what's happening here in Singapore, that's how I see it. Sorry, this is my hobby horse, I couldn't resist the comment. So would you like to comment on this pleasure and pain part?
Yeah, I think I think that's very true. I think that's, you know, this is the problem in life. You have a lot, you want more, and you have a lot, and you lose it, and it becomes painful again. This is exactly right. And of course, one of the basic principles in Buddhism is that you have a lot, then you lose it because of impermanence, and then it becomes suffering. And so, you know, in the end, you can't really win. And you realize there's something deep inside of you which says, this might be lost. So then you become possessive. You hold on to it. You grasp onto your possessions. And you can't really let go. And all that holding on, the grasping, the trying to hold on to something which actually cannot be held on to, is all suffering. Is all part of the same problem. So, having possessions often turn around, and then they become painful. You have been in political power, like the PAP here in Singapore, which has, you had 66% at the last election, they only have 60 now, and it's a disaster for them. Oh, we're going down, what's going wrong? So you can see again, that is a certain kind of suffering, I assume, for those PAP politicians, because they're seeing that we're going down. And it's true, it's true of all worldly power. You know, you've been the president of the United States or something, then afterwards you lose that position. I remember, I think it was Tony Blair, who was the Prime Minister of England for 10 years or whatever. And he said that it is one of the greatest kind of ego pleasure, one of the greatest buzzes in life, is to be in power. Power is such it's a very, very powerful, it's a powerful thing, power. So it really kind of boosts you and really sort of gets you going. And it's something very addictive. We say it's the most addictive thing in the world, apparently, power. And once you lose it, you feel this emptiness because you've lost something which was so important there. So yes, that's why fading away, as you say, is very nice, because then you don't have anything to hold on to, you don't have anything to do. This is the thing about, the Buddha. He faded away from the world. He disappeared. He was still there to teach people. Then he passed away, and that was it. And he's not around anymore. Ajahn Brahm likes to joke always, of course, that the more he fades away, the more popular he becomes. It's one of those conundrums, you try to fade away, but in one way you fade away, in another way you don't fade away. It's like a kind of double-edged thing there.
We can have one last question so that we can all go down to the Vesak festival downstairs. The volunteers and those manning the stalls, they are waiting for us. Yes, I see a hand there.
Hi, my question is about the craving. We are supposed to reduce craving, but I feel that the craving seems to be the basis of the improvement in the mankind in terms of technology, medical advancement, and so on. All this stems from the craving to improve, to lead a better life, and so on. So the question is a little bit of craving good for us in terms of the overall well-being, but not too much of it?
The thing is that you have to, I think, distinguish between the personal practice and the practice of society, because these are two different things. And on the personal level, the less craving you have on the personal level, the happier you're going to be, regardless of how rich the society is around you. And this is the thing. I mean, sometimes you see people who live in very, very poor circumstances. You go to India, and you see these people who are literally dirt poor. They are dirty, they haven't washed, they have nothing. And yet sometimes they have a beautiful smile on their face. And you wonder, how can it be that the most poorest person has a beautiful smile on their face, and then they go to any city anywhere in the world which is wealthy and big and large, and people often look miserable there. This is the case, because city life is stressful. You can't smile to every person around you because there's too many people, so you look miserable instead. And this is often the case. So on a personal level, it's always, less craving is always the path. And then it doesn't matter whether you're rich, it doesn't matter whether you're poor. It doesn't really, all of these things become irrelevant. And on a societal basis, yes, it is true that sometimes the craving will actually move society forward. But the point is that society is going to move forward anyway. There's plenty enough craving in the world. So even if you reduce your craving a little bit, even if everybody here reduces the craving a little bit, even if every person in Singapore reduces the craving a little bit, which is not going to happen, the majority is going to increase their craving, but some people reduce their craving, it's not going to affect society as a whole. You're still going to advance, you're still going to move in the right direction. Remember that the Buddha existed 2,500 years ago. He was the one who taught about the ending of craving. And yet society has advanced enormously in those 2,500 years. It hasn't made much of an impact, the fact that the Buddha taught his teachings. So I wouldn't worry about that. It's a bit like when people say, oh, you know, how can you become a monk? Because if everybody became a monk, you know, the world would stop. You know, it's a pie in the sky. It's irrelevant because it's never going to happen. So you don't have to even think that question. It's the chance that everybody becoming monks and nuns is zero. So you don't need to think like that. I think on a personal level, the answer is the less craving, the more happy you're going to be. Full stop.